abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Monday, February 10th, 2014. Before we get to our guest today, Anthony Gregory, I want to share with you a neat little story from my weekend. I went out of town to a couple of speaking engagements this weekend, and one of them was the Austrian Student Scholars Conference at Grove City College, where I gave the Ludwig von Mises lecture. And you may recall, you faithful listeners, maybe about a month ago or a month and a half ago, I mentioned this conference, and I said that if you are an undergrad or a grad student and you have a paper that you might be able to deliver at this conference, here are the details. You should get in contact with them, because what a wonderful and unusual opportunity for young graduate students or even undergrads to get a paper presentation under their belts at a professional conference. So sure enough, one of my listeners did call up and say, yeah, I'm out in California, I'm a grad student here, I've got a paper that I think would be appropriate for the conference. So sure enough, he flew out and et cetera. Well, the conference gives away cash prizes to the top three papers. Guess who won the $1,000 first place cash prize but the Tom Woods Show listener? How about that? So this guy who had known nothing about this conference until he heard it mentioned right here, walks away with $1,000. I mean, what does that tell you about what? I mean, who knows what the future could hold for you? The windfall you might enjoy someday as a Tom Woods Show listener. Well, anyway, I was so thrilled about that. We're going to have him on because his paper was so good and so interesting. I'm going to have him on as a guest one of these days in the near future. And I guess this is as good a time as any to remind you guys that you are really helping me out to pay the bills here in my little quiet office that I have. At no cost to yourself, when you're about to make a purchase on Amazon, just remind yourself, oh, that guy who slaves away to make me a free show every day, what's he telling me to do about my purchase? Oh, yeah, I'm supposed to go to tomwoodsradio.com and enter Amazon from there, and I'm helping out the show without having to pay anything extra myself. Everybody's happy, especially me. All right, let's turn now to Anthony Gregory. Anthony is the Gilbert I. Collins Fellow at the Independent Institute, independent.org. He's the author of the book, The Power of Habeas Corpus in America, From the King's Prerogative to the War on Terror, published last year by Cambridge University Press. Anthony holds a bachelor's degree in history from the University of California at Berkeley. And before I bring him on, I want to share with you a post of his from Facebook late last week. My wife said to me late last week, hey, did you see Anthony's update on Facebook? And I basically don't get a chance to look at Facebook much in terms of people's updates. I'm just trying my best to maintain my page, my Thomas E. Woods Jr. page, which you guys all like, right? Facebook.com/Thomas E. Woods. So I didn't see it, so I went over and looked at it, and it's like the best Facebook post I've ever seen. So I want to share this with you before bringing Anthony on. So he writes, I sincerely want to learn about as many major government atrocities as I can. I don't want to miss anything big, and I'm always looking to learn about more. Yet I find that someone's tendency to actually teach me something I haven't already learned is almost inversely proportional to how presumptuous and rude they are when describing it to me. And so in response to my writing about the Nazis, when someone says, "You never condemned Stalin for the Holodomor," it turns out they're wrong. Or when I'm describing international communism as perhaps the most destructive evil of the 20th century, someone will actually say, "You don't know anything about Leopold," which is presumptuous and false. He murdered millions, brutally, I know. Or they might say, "But the U.S. carpet-bombed Vietnam and Cambodia." Yes, I've written more about those atrocities than most people who aren't specialists on the topic. And when I did, I found out from a critic that I never read anything about Pol Pot's killing fields. But of course I have. and I agree that everyone should. Or in response to my writing about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, someone says, "You forgot about the rape of Nanking." It turns out I never forgot about it. But when I do talk about it, I notice some people think that Japan's atrocities aren't worth discussing at all because the U.S. was imperialist too. In response to my condemnation of Obama's drone bombing, someone will often say, "You never complained about Bush's lying about WMD in Iraq." But it turns out, actually, I wrote dozens of articles touching on the topic. And back when I did so, people protested that I never called out Clinton for Waco, which of course I did, many times. And when I attacked Clinton for Waco, sometimes liberals would push back and say, "How come I'm such a right-winger? How come I never wrote about the Philadelphia police bombing the Move House in 1985? Actually, I've written about that too. Scrutinizing American foreign policy in general leaves me open to the criticism that I know or care nothing about Russia's human rights abuses or the backwards totalitarianism of many Islamist regimes. And yet if I talk about those, all of a sudden I'm turning a blind eye to U.S. atrocities in the war on terror. And I can't help but be conscripted into the Civil War. If I criticize chattel slavery and the Confederacy, I get attacked for not writing at that very moment about Lincoln's rape of Atlanta. If I condemn Sherman's march to the sea, it must be because I didn't know the Confederacy invaded Pennsylvania and smashed civil liberties. Don't get me started on the American Revolution. If I bash the Catholic Church for the Crusades, it must be because I know nothing about violence by secular regimes. But if I write about that, it turns out I must not know about the 30 Years' War. So I repeat, I have every interest in knowing in some reasonable detail and with as accurate as possible an understanding about all the horrible things so many governments have ever done to people. Some would say it's been an unhealthy interest of mine for too long. There is so much to know, and it's an unpleasant and yet important bottomless topic. And I welcome anyone with even more reasons for me to hate humanity's capacity to be downright inhumane. But if my experience is informative, the more aggressive you come at me, the more likely you are to tell me that 9/11 was a horrible event, or that the British bombed German civilians, or that Germany bombed British civilians, or that Mao starved millions, or that the U.S. government's wars have been based on lies. I know. There is not enough time on earth to learn about all the atrocities. Please share what you know. But don't accost me for not writing about every single atrocity in every sentence I write due to my alleged ignorance or dishonesty. Ladies and gentlemen, I have kept you from Anthony Gregory too long. Check him out at anthonygregory.com, and I'd like to welcome right now to the program Anthony Gregory. Anthony, thanks for being here.
Hey, Tom, it's my pleasure.
All right, there's so many things we can talk about. You know, I think it's almost like we could have a subset of this show just having you on regularly and just talking. And I sometimes, you know, I was saying to you off the air that I feel like some of our previous conversations would have made great podcasts if I hadn't been so stupid. You know, if I had thought, well, you know what, let's record this for posterity, because it's so much fun and so interesting, I find, to talk to you. And the funny thing is, you know, you and I, if we look on paper, you and I agree on like 98.9% of things. I mean, maybe more than that. And yet we just have great fun talking about the 1.1%. And they're all things that don't matter that much in the grand scheme of things. I mean, once you accept the non-aggression principle, you know, other things are sort of negotiable. But anyway. So I've got you here. You write prolifically in the sense that you write multiple pieces a year that make me envious, that multiple pieces that make me say, oh my gosh, if only I could have written that piece. And I'm not saying that just to flatter you. I say that about very, very few writers. But your archive at lourockwell.com, which we'll link to in the show notes here, is just one gem after another. I mean, one precious gem after another. So I just want to pick your brain a little bit, if you don't mind. I want to get inside that brain that can write pieces like that. So I want to start off with something that you and I have kind of, you know, sparred over a little bit. And yet, again, when you get right down to it, what are we really arguing about? But we both feel like the left is hopeless and the right is hopeless, right? You know, for different reasons. And yet, though, in our heart of hearts, like if we were in a CIA interrogation room and we had to give an answer, well, you know, I still have sort of sympathies kind of for the right. And I have a feeling that if you had to say, well, maybe you would be more comfortable a little bit on the left. So I want you, first of all, to tell me, if you were talking to somebody out there in Berkeley where you went to school and you want to turn them on to libertarianism, how would you approach that? How would you tackle that challenge?
How would I tackle the challenge of reaching out to a left winger at Berkeley?
Right. I mean, like, how would you go about it? What would be your plan of attack? What would you start with first?
Well, I think that there's a lot of agreement. You know, Walter Block often points out that if you were to divide issues, and this is somewhat artificial, into the three categories of economic liberties and personal or civil liberties and foreign policy, he points out that it's interesting that in two of those three cases, we superficially at least seem to have more in common with the left, and yet historically the libertarian movement has been more allied with the right. And I don't know what he draws from this in terms of conclusions. I think it's actually significant. I think that on a lot of the most important issues, I feel like my instincts, we're talking not about the deepest theory or application in all areas of human life, but a lot of the instincts, I feel, there's more of a camaraderie between the left and libertarians. And one way that I put this recently was, you know, most good people agree that violent crime and actual crimes against person and property are significant. And yet, if you look at government crime, if you look at the ones that conservatives are weaker on, they're the worst crimes. Murder, torture, kidnapping, rape. These are things that conservatives' beloved institutions, like the military and the prison system, tend to be more overtly involved in. And the best that I think we can say is that the left might be worse on theft and fraud. Now, I know this is a very superficial introduction, and I didn't quite answer your question of how I would approach the leftist. I think it depends on what the leftist and I share in common, and it's easy for me to talk to leftists. Maybe it's just because I've been used to it, living in the Bay Area my whole life and going to Berkeley, but I don't see it as a challenge. Of course, I'm also used to talking to conservatives, too, so it's often pretty easy for me to find some common ground somewhere.
All right, well, let me now, even though you didn't ask for it, I'm going to give you how I go about talking to these right-wingers, because I think to myself, I used to be one of these people. First of all, did you ever think of yourself as being like a Berkeley radical? Like, were you always a libertarian, or did you come from the left, or were you just libertarian from the start?
I've been pretty libertarian since I was a kid. I was raised with a lot of libertarian beliefs. I saw myself as kind of a conservative libertarian, but I was always, you know, for legalizing drugs, and I didn't like wars and stuff like that. But I've probably become more and more left-leaning as the years went on after I was in college, actually. It was just watching the Bush administration and the craven way that conservatives sucked up to what I think was the worst administration in my lifetime that completely dislodged any attachment I had to conservatism.
Yeah, I'm going to admit something here before I go into what I was going to say before about how I go after people on the right. I'm going to admit that in the year 2000, I was sitting in a bar with John Carney, he was at CNBC, and now I think he just took a job with the Wall Street Journal. I mean, I want our people at these institutions. I mean, the more of our people there are, the better. And we're sitting in a bar in Manhattan. We're watching the election returns come in. And everybody else in the bar is rooting for Gore. And they're all cheering every time a state turns red or whatever on the screen. And we went into this thing having no dog in this hunt at all. Couldn't care less which one of these jerks wins. By the end of the night, I was so disgusted with the people in the bar. We were cheering like savages for Bush. I mean, I just can't believe, I am, I didn't vote for him, I'm happy to say. I never voted for him, or I never voted for anybody with the last name of Bush. But my gosh, am I mortified. But you know what? I want to share this with people because I don't want to give the impression that, look, I'm just always right, and everybody who disagrees with me is a stupid head, and I should talk down to him. I always go out of my way not to talk down to people. I don't always succeed. You know, nobody's perfect. But because I think to myself, look, just, you know, 14 years ago, I was so stupid that even though I saw the world pretty clearly, I was still actually vocally cheering for George Bush. All right, so here's how I go after them, though. I say, what do conservatives believe in, if not stability, prudence, and moral absolutes? And then I apply that to the military, and I apply that to the foreign policy. And I say, well, this Jacobin foreign policy has not given any stability to anybody. It's obviously not prudent. Oh, gee, let's just attack Iraq. I bet there won't be any long-term consequences that we'll regret from that. And moral absolutes, well, for heaven's sake, consider the possibility that, imagine if these policies were carried out on us. Or I say, and this worked, you know, remember that Nullify Now speech in Los Angeles? I've had a lot of people say that speech made them think. Because I said, look, you people are better than this. Just treating these Iraqis like garbage, or just anonymous nobodies you can just starve and torture and not care about. I mean, what? I mean, if the left acted this way, or the Soviet Union acted this way towards some people, we'd never hear the end of it from you people. But, you know, whatever happened to moral absolutes? And then also, think about Bill Kaufman. When Bill Kaufman talks about the costs of empire, he's talking about the costs on local communities, on flesh and blood relationships, on the things that conservatives are supposed to value, hearth and home, and how those things are perverted by the empire. And then when we get to controversial things like drugs, which I would bring up last because that's going to be the hardest thing, that's harder than foreign policy, I think, I say, look, the left are the people that you criticize for being utopians. But what's more utopian than saying that something a whole lot of people are going to demand and that the market is providing can actually be stopped by governments, the clumsiest institution in the world? And that, I mean, you really think the most humane way to deal with drug abuse is prison rape? Like, you can't think of a more humane alternative than that? And plus, of course, it gives the government all this power over searching your home, over your finances, over privacy. It yields all these negative outcomes, and you don't even succeed at it anyway. Why would you think if the government can't succeed against poverty, it can't succeed against this and that, why would it succeed here? This is something for families to take care of one at a time. You can't stamp out all the sin in the world. That's the sort of thing you accuse the left of trying to do. You're supposed to be conservatives. I try and do that. Now, am I wrong? I mean, not that you think I'm wrong, but why ultimately do you think the conservatives are so hard to reach? What do you think is the stumbling block there? Because it seems like the superficial argument I've just made ought to appeal to more of them than it actually does.
Well, I applaud your efforts, and I believe you've had a lot of success in moving conservatives more toward a libertarian understanding. And I also agree with you that conservatives, by their own values, should probably be a lot less, you know, pro-empire and pro-police state than they are. I do think that there's a tension in conservative ideology. You mentioned moral absolutes and stability. I think there's a tension that's there. I think that even this kind of Burkean conservatism isn't really about moral absolutes. I think that it has a propensity toward clinging toward institutions as they've existed, toward maintaining social power relations and hierarchies. And I think that the natural course is for some of those social hierarchies and relations to exist more or less naturally, but a lot of them require constant propping up by state violence. And so, you know, if it were the 1920s, the conservative position on drugs would be, we better keep alcohol illegal and make sure the government never ban marijuana, because that happened to be the combination of drug laws that existed in the 1920s.
Ah, yeah, status quo. Okay, good. I like
So we have this government that we live under in the United States, focusing on the United States, that I actually would agree with you that the progressives and the Democratic Party and the ideology underlying the Democratic Party have probably had more to do with constructing in the last century or so than the conservative reaction against it. And so we're still living under that progressive framework, but the conservatism has seemed to me to mostly take into attempting to preserve that progressive structure as it's been constructed, and as well as just having some kind of terrible other views that are even worse than the progressive establishment. I mean, I think that conservatism itself is flawed. Now, if you're talking about Bill Kaufman-style conservatism, I don't think that's, you know, the greatest enemy of freedom or decency at all. But what's interesting to me when I'm talking to, conservative-leaning libertarians and they want to tell me about all the great conservatives there are, they mention about five or six people.
I have
half those people on my speed dial. I mean,
I know. I used to joke with Jack Hunter about this. You know, like, oh, who are the real conservatives? There are like eight of them.
Yeah. So Jack Hunter, exactly. I mean,
I know.
How many of these great conservatives that I haven't personally chatted with on Facebook in the last week are there?
But you know what, Anthony? I mean, it really does cut both ways, because I'm sure there are a lot of progressives who feel like, look, Hillary Clinton is no progressive. She's a warmonger corporate statist. You know, and yet the typical Rush Limbaugh listener thinks that the world is divided between the right-wing corporate statist and the establishment liberal corporate statist, and that's the world, and we've got this Muslim who wants to sell out America to the Islamists, even though he supports gay marriage, which is a pretty unorthodox Islamic view, according to my understanding anyway, but that's their view, and then we've got to be great patriotic Americans supporting the military against this Muslim usurper. What do you even do? I mean, all you can do is just be grateful that the demographics are changing and that in 20 years it might be possible to get some more sense out there into the mainstream.
Well, no, I mean, I agree with you. And when it comes to liberals, you know, Democrats, kind of the center-left, which dominates Democratic politics, I couldn't agree more. I think it's kind of telling that the best liberal is Glenn Greenwald, and he's not even in the United States because he's afraid of the liberal president.
That's right.
I think, you know, yeah, I commented on, you know, one of my left libertarian friends' Facebook recently that I sometimes think that if you're going to talk about alliances, the real realists who... And the people who are thoughtful and yet radical would really be gravitated toward a very impossible center-right radical-left coalition. And you know, she said, well, that's never going to happen. And so once again, I have this great strategy for liberty that'll never happen. But I think that if you're comparing the center-right to the center-left, the center-right, some of the stuff I dislike most about it, I attribute to its pandering to other segments on the right. And I think that a lot of, you know, normal Republican voters have a more realistic view of what the state is. They know that the state is about the military, the cops. It's an institution of force. Their problem is they support a lot of that stuff, but they don't have any illusions about what the state is at its core. And it's kind of interesting because the center left is, which I think dominates, certainly Obama, you know, the age of Obama, that's what we live under. It's kind of the worst of all worlds, at least in terms of state policy, where you get a lot of the types of policy a center rightist would adopt, like Bush and Obama, they probably agree with each other in practice more than you and I agree.
Yeah, I think so too, and you know, I think you've really hit on something here, because right, the center left and the people who sort of follow them would tend to view the state naively. They would view it as some kind of public service institution.
Right.
Whereas the center right, they will come out and say, look, the state is no such thing, and it's a terrible monster you have to be afraid of, and so therefore, what we can use it for is not to uplift the downtrodden, because it's no good at that. If we're going to use it for anything, we're going to use it for killing. We're going to embrace what it really is, and we're going to just use it for killing, and we're going to employ the hangmen and the jailers, because that's what the state really is. Like, when you really have to go after your enemy, you decimate him with the state, but you don't build houses with it. You don't give people health care with it. You use it as, you know, you're a killer. So, I mean, like, I feel like, well, you know, I don't like that view at pretty much any level. And I don't like the left sort of view either. I'd rather just say, here's the nature of the state. That's why we have to think of different ways of living. Not embrace any aspect of it, but reexamine any unexamined assumptions in our lives that have bought into the image of the state as helping us in any way, either through uplift or through bashing people over the head.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's interesting is the radical left also seems to understand what the state's about, which is why the radical left seems to be divided between totalitarians who just embrace that and anarchists who reject it. And their goals, a lot of the left-right distinction isn't so much about attitudes about the state as it is about, you know, cultural attitudes and what you believe society should look like. And I think that I agree with 1960s Rothbard that historically libertarians agreed more with the left about culture, and this ended up being warped because of progressivism and Marxism in the 20th century. And so I've kind of added on to his insight with a theory that the reason that the state left, you know, state communism, is about the worst thing there possibly is because the state is attempting to do something so opposite of its nature. And the further you drive the state to try to bring about equality and to try to break down hierarchy and power, the more you end up with killing fields and mass starvation. Whereas the right, a lot of its goals are actually more obtainable through the state if all you're trying to do is maintain some sort of, you know, conservative power structure. Now, you could attack anything that I've said with about 100 critiques, and maybe many of them would be correct, and we could go down these roads forever. And of course, the whole political spectrum, or this theoretical spectrum between left and right, is flawed, and I don't know how much it applies to American politics in the end. I mean, people just vote for. There's an old joke that people either their parents were Democrats, so they end up voting Democrat, or their parents were Republicans, so they end up voting Democrat. But
yeah.
But either way, but the actual truth in that joke is that a lot of this ends up being partisanship, which is why even news, there are all kinds of news events that everyone lines up behind, not based on what the actual story's about, but just what you would predict the Democrats or Republicans to say. And it's kind of, I shouldn't say kind of, it's quite disturbing to me that people allow their intellects to be totally subverted by partisan loyalty.
I want to pick your brain, though, on one key thing that you've talked and written about quite a bit. Let's suppose you're talking to somebody who identifies as a progressive but isn't really that politically astute, doesn't really know all the distinctions, but just feels like it's the responsibility of a progressive to support Barack Obama because he's out there fighting against the reactionary Mitch McConnell or whatever. What would you say to him about the Obama record? Not the pretty speeches, not the enthusiasm, not the big crowds that he used to get, but what would you say specifically? Let's say you've got a few minutes with this person. What would you say to disabuse this person, to get the person thinking that, you know what, I mean, I certainly don't want to support Mitch McConnell, but maybe I don't want to support anything about this system, because maybe they're all, at some fundamental level, the same.
Well, on foreign policy, which is a good starting point, the points are easy to make.
But Iran, Obama, though, but I should interject here, though, Iran, hasn't he actually been sort of good, at least recently?
Well, okay, Tom, I mean, if you corner me, I'm actually going to concede. I think that the Democrats are a little better on foreign policy,
yeah,
or a little less terrible. And because that difference translates into, you know, hundreds of thousands of lives potentially, I mean, I don't know what role I'm supposed to be playing right now, convincing the progressives to abandon the left or convincing you that the left's better than the right.
No, just talk to me about the progress. But I did want to point out that Scott Horton, who was on this program not long ago, said that basically the Iran thing, which could well be successful, is the only good thing Obama's ever done. And if that is the only good thing he's ever done, it's pretty much better than anything George W. Bush did. And I despise Obama. I despise all the presidents. I mean, that should be obvious. Like, anybody who would lecture me, I don't dislike Obama enough, or I don't oppose his policies enough. I guarantee you I oppose more of his policies than that critic does. But if he's better Iran than George W. Bush, that makes him better than, like, the last five presidents or something. But anyway, so now I'm playing devil's advocate for Obama. The world is upside down, Anthony Gregory. You just keep talking. Don't listen to me. Go make your case to the progressive. Let's hear it.
Tom, you've convinced me. I think I'm going to sign up for the DNC.
There you go.
Now, on foreign policy, Obama has continued, you know, the basic bipartisan approach to Iraq, where he continued the Bush timetable. He tripled the number of troops in Afghanistan. And, you know, now he's getting credit for drawing it back down, but he never had to do that escalation in the first place. On civil liberties, you could make a case he's worse than Bush. He's at least in that same ballpark. He's advanced the this doctrine of the presidential kill list. Detention policy has been a disaster in Guantanamo, which is still open. You know, 5 years, 4 years after he promised it would be closed, it's open. His administration's actively worked to solidify these really troubling doctrines in American law and practice concerning detention policy. He did end torture, but only in the sense that torture, as it was most recently being practiced under Bush, ended at the end of Bush. And in fact, in terms of the actual treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo and elsewhere, there have been reports that things have gotten worse. On immigration, deportations have risen under Obama. On surveillance, I don't think I even have to make the point that Obama has broken promise after promise when it comes to privacy and the Fourth Amendment. And then if you move on to economics, the crown jewel of the Obama administration's domestic policy was a program that he basically lifted from Republicans, that now the kind of Heritage Foundation, Newt Gingrich, Mitt Romney, at some point almost every high-profile Republican endorsed the essence of Obamacare.
The individual mandate, you mean?
The individual mandate and mandating that insurance companies cover pre-existing conditions. The two, you know, key parts that required all the other regulation to make workable. Though, of course, it's not workable. But Obama ran against that too. By the way, when he was running against Hillary in 2008, he said he opposed the individual mandate. So you've got a bunch of progressives defending Obama's kind of corporatist, soft social democracy at home. But what have the results been? I mean, unemployment is lower than it was 5 years ago, but it's been rather high considering. If you look at income inequality, which I think tracks government intervention, I think the more the government intervenes, it tends to exacerbate these disparities. They've continued to get worse under Obama. Black unemployment is worse under Obama. On paper, Obama just looks really bad. If he were a Republican, there'd be very little to defend from progressives, other than a little bit of rhetoric here. You're right that on Iran, he's been less belligerent. But what's interesting is the Democrats, or the progressives, rarely focus on that in trying to defend Obama anymore. Now, of course, the Democrats also were more likely to want to go to war with Syria, which we can attribute to partisan hackery on both sides. But, you know, it is to Obama's limited credit that he backed down.
Yeah, that amazed me. That amazed me. Nobody ever backs down.
That was actually to our credit, Tom. We, as you know, the American people and much of the world stood up and said, "You got to be kidding me." And Obama timidly backed out. And I got to ask you, because, you know, you're a historian and I aspire to be one, has that ever happened? I mean, maybe there were, like, some opportunities for the U.S. to invade Canada that were, you know, or something like that.
I don't know. I mean, mainly because when U.S. foreign policy became, you know, something other than every 30 years we have a war, when it became, during the Cold War, just one intervention after the other, you know, Grenada and then Libya and whatever, they didn't broadcast it for 3 weeks in advance so that we could have a debate. They just announced, oh, by the way, we bombed them. So there was no opportunity really to organize opposition in the first place. But yeah, I mean, the pattern certainly has been that there's some belligerent rhetoric that comes from the U.S., and it always winds up with some kind of airstrike or something. It seems just so anomalous, this particular case, and I can't figure out why the conservatives, all of a sudden, the non-McCain conservatives, were against this. Like, if they were against this, why weren't they against half a dozen other things that were exactly like this? I don't know, and I don't care, as long as they took the right position on this, at least.
Well, in the long term, we should care, because eventually we're going to have a Republican ruler again. And it seems clear to me that a lot of the anti-Obama reaction on the right is partisan. It's not coming from this moral absolutist position. It's coming, and you know, we can be glad, of course, in the short term that it's there, but I'm afraid that a lot of the anti-Obama opposition to the right is no more, you know, it's wide, but it's no deeper than the anti-Bush opposition among liberals.
Yeah, somebody's got to compile a list, maybe put it in book form. These are the things that you people are not allowed to support, even if a Republican proposes them, because remember, you were against them for 8 years, okay? So you're not allowed to support any of the following things, beginning with the individual mandate and the pre-existing condition thing, and these various types of foreign intervention, and this type of spying, and all these different sorts of programs, and federal involvement in education. You're not allowed to support any of those things, or candidates who favor any of those things, or otherwise, I want an apology for your bloviating for 8 years. I'd love to hand everybody a book like that, bash them over the head with it, if I didn't believe in the non-aggression principle.
Well, you'll notice each side identifies this hypocrisy in the other side and yet never looks in a mirror. And
yeah.
So under Bush, I remember argument after argument coming from conservatives. Well, Clinton did this in Kosovo, you know.
Yeah, I was against that too. You know, and at the beginning of this program before you came on, I read to the audience your beautiful and brilliant Facebook post from the other day, which was just, I mean, if you don't make that into an article, then I'm just going to retire and give up on mankind. Because that was, my wife said, did you see Anthony's update today? I said, I don't really get to see anybody's updates anymore on Facebook. And I read that thing and I thought, this is one of the best, most awesome things in the world. Because I am so sick of people saying, oh yeah, well, where were you when so-and-so was doing such-and-such? Well, I was criticizing that.
I know. It's really troubling. And, you know, we're both pretty young, and I'm even younger than you, and yet I feel like I've been at this game for a very long time in terms of being, you know, criticized for being inconsistent. And it really started happening the most under Bush, and, you know, under Clinton I was a student, but as it so happened, I wrote in my high school newspaper condemning the war in Kosovo. I criticized Clinton in like six or seven articles that were read by, you know, a few dozen high school students and faculty, and that was it. But of course people have a right to change their mind as long as they have the right position. But the number of times I've been criticized for turning a blind eye to some random government injustice, and in fact, that was, I was talking about a number of different things in that post. One was the partisan stuff, and the other was just talking about, you know, horrible dictators committing mass murder. And,
right.
And I just noticed that I get a, it's the rudeness that bothers me when someone says, aha, you know, you don't even know that Stalin did this.
Yeah, yeah. And how do you know that?
Yeah, how do you know that?
Not only do I know it, I've written about it, and I've read more than, like, you'll read in three lifetimes about it.
Yeah, and I don't want to be too presumptuous back at them, but
no, that's
I am,
true. That's true, but it tends to be.
But I'm just shocked by, you know, I don't want to get, you know, it's dangerous because I don't want to start taking for granted that people know what I know, but it's just amazing to me that I get criticized for, you know, not being aware that, you know, Bush bombed Iraq or something.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
It's like I've lost hundreds and hundreds of hours of sleep because of that. And is that enough sacrifice given the injustice? Probably not, but
and you
it's
know,
not something I take lightly. And
there are search engines that you can just type in Anthony Gregory and then whatever conflict it is and find out what you've done. Like, it would take 2 seconds out of somebody's time to figure this all out. All right, I want to wrap things up here because I'd love to keep on talking, but then, you know, I don't want to go into the next show that we do together. We'll have that do another show another time. But I appreciate this. I mean, I like occasionally, like sometimes I do a super specific show, like a show on the shutting off the water at the NSA facility in Utah sort of thing. Like I like that. And then I like a sort of stream of consciousness show where I bring on somebody I respect and we just talk about things and see where they take us. So I enjoyed this. I hope you did and I hope the listeners do. I hope people will check you out at anthonygregory.com and I hope we can have you back again sometime.
Wonderful. And I'd be remiss not to say that a lot of my writing is, of course, at independent.org too.
Oh, of course, the Independent Institute, yeah, right, which I also told people about at the beginning, but we've had such stimulating conversation they might have forgotten the details, so I do want to make sure people know. The Independent Institute is one of the handful of organizations that you can sort of really rely on to be giving you the plumb line on things. So, all right, thanks again, Anthony, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, that's the program for today, everybody. Make sure you are a subscriber of this program for free over at iTunes or Stitcher. You can see easy links to get to those places to subscribe over at TomWoodsRadio.com. See you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
The Tom Woods Show.